Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
Okay, so my name is Jeffrey Wolf. I'm a native of Boston, Massachusetts, actually Boston, then Newton, Massachusetts. I am a retired associate professor of Jewish history at Bar-Ilan University at in Israel, in the city of Ramat Gan. I did my academic work at Boston University, where I did a BA in history. And then I went on and did my MA and PhD in Jewish history at Harvard. And subsequent to that, I was a two-year postdoc at Yale. And then I went on, came to Israel, and taught for 30 years at Bar-Ilan University. So that's, wow, how you cram. I started in 1972, so that's how you cram, what, 50 years into
You did a phenomenal job. You did a phenomenal job.
It goes I'm going to tell one thing to the kids. It goes very fast. Don't, you know, enjoy every minute.
There you go. Do you mind if we jump into some student questions?
Absolutely.
All right, and those of you guys.
I should actually say what my specialties are, because history is a big thing. Okay, so first of all, I want to make a comment about something I'm very proud of. So you'll see that this is just a small part of my library, and it's a mess, and it's supposed to be a mess. Although my wife doesn't really believe that, it's supposed to be a mess because it's not compartmentalized. I have Jewish history next to church history, next to Islamic history, there's a book on top of a book about a 20th century Jewish thinker. There's a biography of Shakespeare. And in the end, I actually just put the books together this way, happenstance, but I realized later it reflects my belief that the broader you're reading, the more you know, the more you bring to your understanding of things, the better off you're going to be. And so favoring one type of knowledge over another is not learn as much as you possibly can, because everything's connected. And for those of you who grew up in the United States, if you might be familiar with the old song of Mr. Rogers, all the parts of your body are connected. So the same thing is true in terms of knowledge.
You study so much.
My specialties. All right. So my specialties are, I'm a medievalist. I was initially trained as a medieval historian in medieval Europe. My subspecialties are Jewish history, especially Jews in Renaissance Italy. Vedo qualche italiano qui, I think. I thought so. I spend a lot of time investigating and teaching the interrelations between the three prominent monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, over the centuries. So I really start from the time of Jesus all the way down till today. And it's a lot to handle. But anyway, so that's where I specialize. Okay.
That's amazing. And I find that stuff absolutely fascinating about, you know, where we're from and why we go to church and where does that stuff come from, and, you know, or temple or whatever anyone's belief is on here. We'll
maybe
jump right
very popular in the last 2 days, because I've been interviewed by a number of different media outlets about sort of what's my take on the passing of Pope Francis and the future of Jewish Catholic relations.
Sure. And I'm sure some kids will have some questions on here. I know we have a lot of kids in Catholic countries. One of the kids that emailed me, how does your background in both academia and religious studies influence your teaching approach?
So I guess I should transparent. I am an Orthodox Jew in my personal practice and my belief system. And I think if that influenced me at all in my research, it may just have helped to choose certain, you know, sort of emphases of what I wanted to study. However, once I get down to my work, I do make every single effort, and I think it's possible. I make every single effort to set aside my own personal feelings and let the evidence take me where I go. And then if that's where if I come to conclusions which maybe might diverge with what I believed as a person of faith before, then I have to deal with that. But I'm not going to, I do not certainly do not believe in subjecting facts to ideology or to theory. Theory should grow out of the facts and not the other way around, which is a problem in contemporary academic discourse, I have to say, because all too often people come with their theories and then they try to force the facts into sort of like a Procrustean bed, you know, so like that's the bed where in Greek mythology where they would make you sit in the bed, and if you were too tall, they would stretch you, and if you were too short, they would shorten you. Anyways, so that if my that's I think the only direct influence on it. I'm interested the middle I'm a medievalist and a Renaissance person, so the connection between religious studies and general history is not is natural because there was no secularism. Secularism is a modern creation which starts in the 17th century and even later. The secular world in which we, which is almost hostile to religion, is not the world, is not the history of certainly of the West and definitely not of the East, till the way that we've known it from time immemorial. The idea that one should be without any faith envelope in which you live is simply not, it just didn't exist. In fact, sometimes we talked about making the facts fit the theory, about, you know, one of the people who is ostensibly one of the founders of the secular world is Sir Isaac Newton, the person who created modern physics. Of course, you know, later Einstein changed things and so on, but you know, he is the guy. And the recent and somebody recent they recently donated his private papers to the National Library here in Jerusalem. Oh, I don't live in Jerusalem, but they here in Israel. And it turns out that he spent most of his life trying to crack the secrets of the Bible because he was a profoundly believing Anglican. That got a lot of people very upset. Like, how could that be? But that's who he was. I mean, that there even people who were sinners or who were skeptics, they lived in a world that was infused and defined by the religious tradition. That was the world against which they with which they interacted, and in order to understand them, you have to understand, you know, what their basic value system was in which they functioned. So religious studies and history, if you're really going up till 1789, and in American history, by the way, up till about 50 years ago, there's really no discontinuity.
Wonderful, wonderful. You know, I love how deep you get with that. We have a question from Christopher in Spain. Christopher, you can unmute and ask.
Hello.
Hello.
My question is, what inspired you to pursue this career?
Ah, okay, it's a great question. Partly, I think it was I mean, my first. I was always just. First of all, I grew up in Boston, and you can't really grow up in Boston without having a very strong sense of history, because Boston is where the Pilgrims and the American Revolution started, and we were and education at the time was profoundly impacted. We had to take courses in high school already in American history, and I really loved it. Yesterday, what's today? Today is the 23rd. So earlier this week, well, Saturday rather, was the 250th anniversary of the opening of the American Revolution, and we used to have that. It's a national holiday. It's a state holiday in Massachusetts. We're always there. My father had a very strong interest in the Civil War, and we were very, what shall I say? We weren't Orthodox Jews, but we were very. We had a family that was very traditional, and therefore the idea of Jewish history, and the long trail of Jewish history was also very tangible. So all of that, and stories about my, you know, past families going back a few generations, I think all of that sort of came together. It's interesting when I did my when I picked my I picked my major at Boston University. It was almost like a fluke. It said, "What do you want to major in?" And I looked at the list, and I was like, automatically, like, checked history. So it was like the most. It was just this this thing later, I realized that there were very profound elements in studying history that affect a person very personally. First of all, if you have a topic that you love, then I mean, I had a professor, and it was Nancy Lyman Relker, who was a wonderful, wonderful historian of French history. And she was just impassioned. She just loved France, and then she infected us with this idea that you should love your topic. But beyond that, it was exactly 50 years ago. Oh no, exactly 50 years ago, I was going out with this girl who obviously I did not marry, but I was going out with this girl, and she didn't really understand why one would waste one's life being a historian when you can be a lawyer and make a lot of money. And I was madly in love, so I was willing to take a second look at what I was doing. So I went to go see actually a one of my professors at the time. His name was Norbert Nachum Norbert Glatzer. He was a Jewish historian, but he was German originally. He was born in Germany. See, he was trained in the classical Germanic academic tradition. And I drove out to his house, and we were sitting talking. And so I said, "What's the use? What is all this worth?" So he said something which was really very, very, very powerful for me. He sort of like. His face sort of like changed, it softened. And he said, "There is no experience like touching the past and having it infuse your life." Now, it doesn't mean you're living in the past, but it means that you're attached to something. You feel like, people who live before you are affecting you, and you feel grounded, and you feel a sense of stability, which no other which you know which history is uniquely qualified to do. And I really think that that's true. Now, as later on, I discovered that there were in the early 20th century philosophers, especially a French philosopher named Henri Bergson, who developed this into a philosophy, and that is that human beings, if they don't compartmentalize themselves, actually can access emotionally past events. And then if you really want to get weird, according to one reading, the simple reading of Einstein's theory of relativity, time is fluid, which means that everything that ever happened is happening simultaneously now. That's why the idea of time travel is actually built into the theory of relativity. If you want to see how this possibly could work, there is this wonderful episode of Star Trek. I think it's the first or second, the classic, the original series. It's called The City on the Edge of Forever. And it has actually has Joan Collins in it, which is interesting. In any event, so if you want to see an example of how that expressed itself in the 1960s on TV, then I recommend it. But that's actually a part of these things. I mean, you get to know dimensions of human beings and human experience that are just mind-boggling.
Absolutely fascinating. We have a question from Timofey in Russia, and it kind of touches on that. Timofey, you can unmute to ask your question, friend.
Hi.
Hi.
What do you enjoy most about your work?
Okay, so I'm gonna say something which no professional academic should say. The part I like the least, the part that I find hardest, is writing. I mean, that's what you do as for a living, but I find it hard because I try to bring a lot to every single sentence, and it's hard. I like just reading. I like reading as widely as possible about places and times that I knew nothing about. I love the experience of learning things that I didn't know is just mind-boggling. And all the more so is reading primary sources. Primary sources are things that the people that you're studying actually wrote, whether it's diaries, whether it's laws, whether it's chronicles, and you try to crack their code because they had different ways of expressing themselves. So you don't just because it might be written, things might be written in a language that the words don't always mean the same thing. And sometimes they sort of like shade things one way or the other and you can try to climb into their heads. But when you touch, that's really touching the past. The same thing, by the way, is and I haven't done it as much as I would have liked, going to places where things that you wrote about or know about happened, because that's really that just that is something which just it's just incredible. You and I said this person stood here and this is what happened, and you can sort of you have to being a historian is a profession that demands that you use your imagination, not wild. It's not CGI, but it's sort of like, how would I, you know, it's in my mind's eye, how did I see these things occur? Now, living here in Israel, that's sort of like every day, because you know things have been going on around here for, you know, 10,000 years. But it's true. I mean, with the times I've been in the times that I've been in Europe, I get it. I, you know, it goes back to you know, going to Lexington Green and the Concord Bridge. The same deal. And the fact that things come together. So you can walk down, for example, in Boston. If you're walking down Arlington Avenue, which is the main road that the British Army took to Concord Lexington 250 years ago. So every like few hundred yards or meters, whatever you're going to use. I mean, more or less, this is where X happened. So most people just walk by and they don't pay attention. But oh, you know, if you pay attention, if you stop, oh, this is where, it's really something very very striking. I got the same feeling in Prague, I remember, because Czech history is something. The Czechs are such interesting people, and they never went with the flow. So I always, and by the way, and Italy is forget it. I mean, it's every 30, it's every 5 feet. It's not, you know, the place closest to Israel in terms of massive historical significance every 30 inches, and then going down is in Italy. I mean, you know, you go to the Fontana Trevi, and then you go behind it, and you go to the Roman waterworks underneath it, and it's, you know, you go to Piazza Navona, and underneath Piazza Navona is the remains of the stadium that was built by the guy who made the Arch of Titus, whose brother destroyed Jerusalem. It can blow your mind. Like, if this is, you know, this is stuff that's really very, very tangible. So I think those are the parts that I enjoy the most. To make a living, you have to write books and articles. So I do that. And, but the real good part is just sitting there and letting information come in.
That's amazing. What would you say, this comes from me, like, what is one of the oldest documents that you've ever read? Like, would it be like Paleo Hebrew or?
No,
like...
I don't go that far back. I don't go that far back. I think the oldest things that I've read are inscriptions. Oh, no, I'm sorry. The oldest thing I've ever read are inscriptions from biblical Judea that were in museums. But generally speaking, the what I, in terms of my ongoing work, I mean, I think the pieces that I have, early gospels. There is a famous stele that I taught about that they found in Caesarea, which is the only the only solid mention of Pontius Pilate on it. And then, you know, then as a medievalist, so I mean, basically, we're talking about medieval Latin, medieval Hebrew, and then proto-French, proto-Italian, and proto-German inscriptions and documents. It's easy. You can be a little lazy when you're a medievalist, because if you're an ancient historian, you've got to try to make. You have to use archaeology, which means you have to make stones talk, which is not easy. And it's a lot more speculative. In the Middle Ages, you have things that people wrote. So you have something you can really sink your teeth in. A lot got lost, and that doesn't mean you have a full picture of how everything worked. But that's one of the things that being a historian should do. I don't know if all my colleagues are like this, but you learn a lot of humility. Because there's a lot that didn't make it. So you're basically trying to put together a puzzle with a lot of pieces missing. And yet that's part of the excitement, because you, what you do have, and every time you find a new piece, the picture gets much clearer.
That's great. We have a question from Anthony in France. Anthony, you can unmute to ask your question.
Hello, science. I want to become a teacher researcher in history. Could you give me some advice to know in which part of history I should specialize in my future studies? Thank you very much.
I'm going to be totally obnoxious. You have to do what you what you have to go. You have to go where you like. Don't ever let anybody. Don't ever let anybody dictate to you. The thing to do is just read. Read as broadly and as deeply as you can, and see what grabs you. When you get to university, and there, listen, one of the best schools for historical research is l'École supérieure des hautes études in Paris. In fact, it's the place. The one of the school one of the one of the, one of the schools in which I was trained is called the Annales School, which is sort of like a this school that takes that teaches that in order to understand anything that happened, you have to not only look at what the great people did in the wars and the kings and the queens and the popes and stuff like that, you also have to know how much bread cost and things like that. And that was their angle. That you have to just read and read and read and read and read and talk to people who are also interested and develop your own ideas. It's a lot of it is just a lot of it is what's the word? Eliminate. It's a work of it's a process of elimination. But look at and sometimes somebody'll push you to do something. I had it when I was an undergrad. When I was an undergrad, I had a professor. My actually my the, my first mentor, I think, in medieval history. His name was Reinhold Schumann. And he, like many German historians, was absolutely in love with Northern Italy. And he had written, in fact, he wrote his doctorate, and his major work was a history of the Commune of Parma. And he was pushing me to go into a similar to you know to pick a city and do it like many historians do. And I said, no, I want to do France, and I want to do Germany in the Middle Ages, and I want to do Robin Hood. I had you know I was and I was really not well that obnoxious. I was pretty stubborn about it, and in the end, I ended up studying Northern Italy and the Renaissance and the Baroque. So, you know, sometimes, despite yourself, you end up going where people are pushing you. But that's my best advice, and that's the fun part, because even if you read one book, say you decide you want to read about you want to do the Carolingian era, or you want to do. Or you want to do you want you saw Marco Polo on Netflix, which by the way is an amazing series. You saw Marco Polo on Netflix saying, "Ah, I am in love with Kublai Khan, one of the ugliest people who ever lived." Okay, I'm in love with Kublai Khan, so I'm going to go to you. I'm going to learn Mandarin, and I'm going to learn this, and I'm going to learn that, and then after a while you say, "No, I don't want this anymore." But you know what? You'll know about Mongol China, which will open up vistas for you in terms of anything else you want to do. So it's a win-win proposition, which I if you don't mind, I this is one thing I did want to say. All right, I'm not I, this is not about politics at all. There were many wars and many conflicts and many cultural conflicts going on throughout the West and throughout the world. One of the things which makes me crazy is that the people who express opinions, whether they're in the media, whether they're politicians, whether it's just the average person, hasn't got a clue about what's going on because they don't know the history behind it. Okay, that's really real. Now you can interpret history in many ways. You once you have the facts, you can decide that this side is better than that side, and so on. Okay, that is absolutely true. But people haven't got a clue, and they wing it, and that's not a responsible way to make a decision, especially when it comes to things which are really matters of life and death for other people. I have over my desk a cartoon which you can find on you can just Google it. which is a takeoff on a Harvard philosopher. His name was, he was actually Spanish, George Santayana, which was that those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. So in the cartoon, there's an older professor telling his student, and he's surrounded by much better organized bookshelves than I have. And he said, I'm just going to read it to you. Those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. Yet those who do study history are doomed to stand by helplessly while everyone else repeats it. Don't be like that. I mean, be an informed citizen, and that's what history does. It's really, really critical that we know what the history is, and that way you can have a critical opinion about theories of where you live, whether they're right or wrong. Otherwise, you're at the mercy of some who, you know, might sell you a bill of goods, and that's, you know, really tragic, I think. Anyway, I needed to get that in there. So, in other words, so even if you're not going to become an historian, I think it behooves anybody to. So the Europeans among you already know that it's very important to know more than one language, and a lot of you already do. For Americans, that's like, what? What? We should just do it in English. What happened? And that's a mistake as well, because you can't. One of the things that my training required was that I learn languages. I mean, I read or speak nine languages, and that's not abnormal. Okay,
That's
because
amazing.
you need to be able to, no, because you need to be able to read the things in the tradition.
Sure,
You know,
sure.
there's a Latin expression, tradicere, traducere. If you translate, they betray, because you never quite get it. So, but I will give you one more, another example in terms of contemporary whatever. In the Russian Ukraine war, okay, I'm not saying that's not taking time sides, whatever. But you gotta understand that when Putin says that Ukraine that Russia was founded in Kyiv, he's right. That doesn't mean Ukraine doesn't exist and all this other stuff. I mean, that he's playing on historical memory. Ukraine as an entity had its own history in which it resisted Russian takeover and Polish takeover, by the way. One of the great Cossack rebellion of the 17th century that was led by Bogdan Khmelnytsky, the national hero of the Ukraine, was against the Poles who tried to take over and violate the integrity of Ukraine. But and you know what? Ukrainians know that, and Russians know that, and that somewhere in their calculus, it's playing a role. Okay, or the British and the French. So the British and the French, I'm sorry, the French and the Germans have been going at it. Said everybody knows all French and Germans. Do you know when it started? It started in 842 as a family fight between the children of the grandchildren of Charlemagne, who's going to get the Rhineland. Wow. So this is not something new. Oh, that's interesting. That's important to know. You're not just starting with something, you know, happenstance. Anyways.
We're all getting some deep history lessons here. I love it.
Yeah,
We'll go with.
and Ralph wanted to know whether 15 minutes was going to be too much.
No, you're good. You're good. We'll go with two more student questions, and we'll let you go. We have a question, and I think Judaism is beautiful culture. I go to temple on Fridays for Shabbat. We have a question about Judaism from Italy. This is Angelo in Italy, and Angelo, you're in northern Italy, I believe. We have a lot of students in Verona area.
Wow.
Go ahead and ask your question.
Angelo, dove vivi?
Hi, I'm from Brescia,
Okay.
Brescia near Verona.
Okay.
Okay.
Hi, thank you.
I have a
And
book. I have a book over here that lists all the Jews who lived in Brescia in the 15th century.
interesting. And I wanted to
Non c'erano molti.
ask you, what is actually the definition of being a Jew? Is the religion intrinsically overlying with the ethnicity?
Okay, so classically, all right, the other people will argue it, but historically speaking, Judaism is a religion in which the national dash ethnic and religious elements are so intimately intertwined and interstitched that it is effectively impossible to separate them. In fact, what's interesting is that conversion, that in the traditional conversation, look, there are people who will argue. I'm just saying traditionally, as it conceives itself, there are plenty of Jewish people say they're only religion, and plenty of people say it's only a nationality. But I'm saying in terms of the way that the Jewish tradition from the Bible on has defined itself is these two elements. It is a covenant, which a religious covenant that was made according to the Bible between God, and that's how, irrespective of historicity, that's how Jews define themselves, based on one people. Now, by the way, that's the reason why Judaism as a religion is not a missionary faith, because as opposed to say Christianity and Islam, where there's either my way or the highway. Judaism has a two-tiered system where there are Jews, and they are the sort of like the priests of the world, and they have certain responsibilities, and everybody else has a certain number of seven obligations. But both paths lead to salvation. Okay, so nobody gets shortchanged. So it's hard. So I'm just saying that's how Jewish tradition is consistently conceived itself, as I say, even though in the modern era there are attempts, and they still are, to try to separate the two. Did that help?
Yeah, no, you did a solid job there.
When a person wants to convert to Judaism, it's really striking. I mean, if a person comes to convert to Islam, so they'll hear about Muhammad. And they'll hear about monotheism, and you have to accept. Basically, you convert by reciting the Shahada, that which is a religious statement. I believe in there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Or if you're a Shia, you say something nice about Ali. And if you want to convert to Christianity, so the emphasis is on original sin and salvation and the significance of the crucifixion and the resurrection and so on. When somebody comes to convert to Judaism, the first thing you tell them is you're joining a bunch of really crazy people who have suffered a lot, and you really want to throw your lot in with them. And it's only after that, it's only in the second part of the initial discussion that you start talking about the Torah and the commandments and the observances and so on, which I think says a lot about the way that the self-definition of Judaism, writ large.
Man, you really knocked that one out of the park. I feel like you practiced that. We got Christina as our final student question. She's in Spain. Go ahead and ask.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. And I personally love history, so I would like to ask you two questions. One of them is, how is historical research done? And how can we apply it to better understanding how different religions correlate with each other more peacefully in our present world?
Okay. Wow. Okay. So in terms of how you research, oh, look, it's, I once, as I said, people who are real historians should really be the most modest and humble of people. And I'll tell you, a friend of mine once pointed out to me that if you take a photograph anywhere of anything, and you decide you're going to describe everything implied by that photograph, you will never finish, because every single thing leads to something else. So that's why there is specialization, meaning that there are some people who prefer to study. I mean, you should study the broad strokes of what happened in events and so on, but some people will emphasize more political history. Some will emphasize religious history. Some will emphasize economic history. It all relates, but you're sort of zooming in on one specific angle: cultural history, women's history, the history of childhood. Because to the best of our knowledge, this is our one run through. You have to, do something well. There's an expression in English: be a jack of all trades and master of one. So that's really what I think. And again, how do you know? So you take a course in this, you take a course in that, or you read a book on this, or read a book on that. I personally am practically and effectively enumerate. That's why I have an accountant to do my taxes, because I would be in jail otherwise, because I can't. I'm really, when I see numbers, I get my eyes glaze over. But some people love, I know people love economic history. They're just like, I mean, I have a friend who's a professor. I won't mention names, but he's a professor at the University of Milan. And if you ask him, like, what bread cost, I'm sorry, what was the value of the Florentine florin at a certain time, he'll get, oh my God. And he'll tell you what they used to pay the architects and what they used to pay the this ones and the, what the bread cost and and the wars between the Venetian ducat and the, I mean, and he can, and I can't stop. I mean, I'm not interested, but I can't stop him because he's so excited. And he'll sit there and tell you, and then he gets into how much, what the weight of the gold in each coin was. And it's like, but these things have implications, by the way, in terms of how people work and wars and all kinds of stuff. So it's again, like the topic, you pick a method or several methods. I personally have done religious history, political history, social history, and some interaction of the three by trying to recreate the way that medieval people saw their world and how they had what emotional reactions they had to each other or to their broader society, as of trying to way to integrate to figure out why they acted the way they did. In terms of religions, there is no substitute for studying each religion on its own and how it developed. And then once you've mastered or have a good solid feel for each religion, how they interacted, and then trying to figure out, you know, if they didn't get along in the past, do your findings seem to indicate, or would they lead you to the idea that maybe they can get along better? Now, one thing about that I think is important to keep in mind, and that is that there is nothing more touchy than religion, and in this, and nothing more intimate. Oh well, there are things that are more intimate, but religion is a very intimate business, and by the way, in this regard, I will put atheism in as a religion. Because it is a absence of faith system. You follow what I'm saying? Okay. In fact, the most dogmatic people I know are atheists, not people of faith. So that being the case, it's very important when studying interreligious relations to not have the temerity to tell someone of a different faith community how they should act. You have to be very respectful. Now, what they do, I don't know what they would do. I don't know. You know, if somebody's going to come and it's going to go, if the Aztecs are going to come back and start pulling people's hearts out, like in the second Indiana Jones movie, I think maybe we'd have what to say. But it's important to realize that one faith community not impose its will on another, but try to understand. And maybe from that discussion, each side could on its own develop some kind of new whatever. This, by the way, it's happened in the past. So for example, in the 1960s, in the context of Vatican II, first at the behest of John the 23rd and then Paul the VI, the Catholic Church, out of dialogue and of mutual understanding, on its own sort of came to ways of adjusting or finding ways within itself to be able to have better relations with Jews and with other non-Catholics. We may be seeing something similar today. The Abraham Accords between Israel and the Emirates appear to be causing Muslim religious scholars to ask themselves the question, well, do we need to have war between Jews and Muslims? And they're coming up with answers that are very, very, very hopeful, but on Muslim terms. No Jewish person, no Christian person can impose and say, you should believe like that. That's not respectful. But by understanding and knowledge, I've always found that my Catholic interlocutors, for example, are very appreciative of the fact, and I'm appreciative when they do it as well, the other way, of the fact that I spent so much time trying to understand Catholic theology and Christian thinking and the New Testament, and I appreciate it when they make the other effort. Now, I will never understand emotionally and spiritually what a crucifix means a picture or a crucifixion in a picture of the crucifixion, or I don't know, what's the name of the new TV show, The Chosen. What The Chosen does, anybody see it? Anybody been watching this thing? It's about, it's like five seasons of history, the story of Jesus. What that does for a Christian, and no Christian will understand fully what I feel when I see a Star of David or when I see a Torah scroll or whatever. But as close as we can come to sort of like approximating it and understanding, even intellectually, that can certainly lead to, I think, very positive respect, mutually respectful results.
Yeah, I'm talking about acceptance and kindness towards people who are different and not non-judgmental, and you know, I love it. So, well, Dr. Wolf, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to speak to us around the world. So, guys, before I end the meeting for all, before I shut it down, I traditionally allow everyone to unmute. So can we all say thank you to Professor Jeffrey Wolf for taking the time to talk to us today? Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.